Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice. Thanks for joining us today.
Today, we're going to be jumping right back into the middle of our book, A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure. And we are going to finally get to that chapter that the book is named for. And this picture on the front is all about. We're going to read two chapters. The first one very short, about crossing the river. And the second one, A Gypsy's Kiss.
Can I say a couple of things about the cover?
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, the cover, do me a favor. Yeah, thank you. The cover was painted by my daughter, Sean Wells, based on my instructions and what I wanted to accomplish. In addition to that, unbeknownst to me, she added a clue to where the treasure was hidden and did it kind of without even asking or discussing, and it was really well done. And if you want to know exactly what the clue is, make a comment below and we'll tell you what to look for.
Yeah. So if you recall, Miguel had gotten to New Orleans on his motorcycle or his uncle's motorcycle, and he made his way down to Bourbon Street and he met Mariah and then spent the evening with her, walking around, enjoying Mardi Gras, the sights and the sounds and the scenes and the people. And then she said it was time for her to go to Algiers, where she stays. And he didn't want to be parted from her, so she asked him if he'd like to come with her. And he agreed that he would like to come with her. So that's where we'll pick it up at. Chapter 25, Crossing the River. Mariah guides us south from Bourbon Street along the river's edge with more lights, noise, and people, but different from downtown. I wonder how she's going to get us across the river. The question is answered a few minutes later. There is a large sign whose decorations match a medium-sized boat painted in white with red and blue trim, and another large sign that runs from front to back that reads, Water Taxi, 50 cents. I reach in my pocket and peel off a $1 bill and pay the salty-looking gentleman at the swinging gate leading to the gangplank and then to the boat. We have to duck to get under the cover. There are handholds at the boat's entry, and we use them as we step over the gunwale and onto the deck. It is less than full, so we find two seats next to one another on the port side. We talk a few more minutes before Captain Salty steps onto the boat, rattles off a list of safety practices, turns around and orders his pair of boat boys to cast off the docking lines. He pushes an L-shaped handle to the right of the helm and puts the boat into gear. He then pushes a similar handle on the left to throttle the boat forward. He turns hard to port and crosses most of the Mississippi before turning again to port and heading downstream for a couple of minutes. He docks the boat at the mirror image of the location we just left, and his two boat boys take lines and tie them up against the bulkhead. Mariah and I follow the others off the boat, over the gangplank, through the gate, and past a line of people waiting to board the Mississippi Water Taxi. Mariah points downstream, saying, "We are going this way, through the carnival, into where I stay." Throughout the night, whenever she talks about it, I notice that she never refers to where she stays as home. Instead, she uses a variety of euphemisms. I take her hand in mine and, assuming the lead, start walking in the direction she pointed out to me. But she holds me up and I turn and ask, "What?" In a bit of a pout, she questions, "You know where you are going?" "I'm going where you tell me to go, yes?" Mollified, she nods, "Yes, this way." We stroll hand in hand toward the carnival. Chapter 26, A Gypsy's Kiss. The carnival is very much like any of the carnivals I have attended with my family during Fiesta weekend every Labor Day in Santa Fe. We stroll through the avenue between tents, lights, carnival music, people playing games, and carnies hustling on behalf of the rides and game tents, all of them with the Cajun accent I've become accustomed to hearing over the past several hours. The smells of a variety of foods, both savory and sweet, mingle with the breeze coming from the Mississippi River. Mariah grabs me with her free hand and stops us, asking, "You will do something for me?" My inner voice silently responds, "I will do anything for you." But outwardly, I just smile back at her, waiting to hear her request. "I want you to play something, something you will like, but it will cost money." "How much money?" I ask. $1, I think. I certainly can afford a buck, and now my curiosity has the best of me. Let's go. This time, Mariah takes the lead and walks with me to a tent not far away. On the doorway of the tent hangs a sign. In a very elegant, mysterious, calligraphic font, it reads, "Gypsy Queen Fortune Teller." I know what to expect because my mother is a fortune teller of sorts. Her friends sometimes come over in the evening to drink wine, and my mother will read the tarot cards for them. They often try to give her money, but she never accepts it, explaining that it would be wrong to do so. We enter the tent. Candles light the space all around. Inside, there is a round table with two chairs. A frail, grandmotherly-looking woman with a red silk scarf tied around her head and a white, billowy blouse that covers her arms all the way down to her wrists, where her tiny hands poke out, sits in one of the chairs. It's like we're in a cliche of a movie about gypsy fortune tellers. She looks up at me with interest, gestures to the open chair, and says something to me I don't understand. Mariah interprets. She tells you to sit down. I slide into the empty chair. The gypsy looks at Mariah and asks her again, in a language I do not comprehend, a question. Mariah says, "Give her $1, s'il vous plaît." I take my stash out of my jeans pocket, peel off a dollar, and slide it across the table. The gypsy takes it and tucks it away in the front of her blouse. She then opens a small wooden box in front of her, pulling back the corners of a red silk wrapping to reveal a well-worn deck of tarot cards. She takes them from the box. Then, folding the silk back into it, she replaces the cover on the box and slides it to one side of the table. Very adroitly, she shuffles the deck three times, evens it up, and sets the deck of cards in front of me. This time, instead of speaking through Mariah, she commands me, "Cut," and holds up three fingers of her right hand. I look at Mariah and ask, "Cut three times or cut it into three stacks?" "Three piles," Mariah answers. I cut the deck pretty evenly into three piles of cards. The gypsy retrieves the piles in an order different from how I had laid them down. She then carefully lays down a square, five cards on a side, all the while making a series of sound effects. While this is going on, Mariah takes one of the other chairs that is set along the outside wall of the tent and pulls it up next to mine. She sits down with her purse in her lap and her hands folded on top of it to watch what comes next. For the next 10 minutes, Mariah has to play the part of the interpreter between the gypsy and me, since they speak a common language that I do not. I don't actually have to say anything. Mariah is asking all the questions on my behalf. Every once in a while, the gypsy picks up one card, points to it, and says something to Mariah, which causes her to react with a giggle, or more oohs and ahs, and then she translates it for me. Apparently, the gypsy worries about me growing up without a father and knows there is emotional conflict between my mother and me. She tells Mariah that I have a curious mind and big heart, and that my destiny is for great things. Pretty much standard fortune teller fare. There is a point, though, at which the gypsy pauses, frowns, and, without looking up from the cards, says something to Mariah. It surprises her enough for Mariah to say, "Oh," and cover her mouth with her hand, as if trying to prevent the word from escaping. I look at Mariah expectantly. It seems to me as if she is thinking about how to construct the sentence that she's about to speak. "It is not all good for you," she says. "What do you mean?" I ask. "The gypsy says that la mort will come for you 7 times. Death? How does that make any sense? You only get one chance at death." Starting to make the argument, I say, "But..." Mariah doesn't let me finish. "But you will win the fight with death each time, until the 8th, and then death will win the match." The room and I turn solemn, sullen. No one likes to think of their own death, certainly not a 15-year-old boy. "When?" I ask. Mariah turns to the gypsy to translate, and the gypsy responds. "The cards do not tell her when, where, or how, just that it will happen." Fair enough. I guess if I plan to lead a life of adventure, there's going to be some risks involved. Although I'm disappointed to hear I have only 8 lives, rather than 9, like a cat. After the reading and interpreting, there is an exchange between Mariah and the gypsy. It seems the gypsy is asking her to do something that causes Mariah to question her in a little louder and higher-pitched voice than I had heard from her to this point. The gypsy repeats the words. Still gripping her purse, Mariah looks at me. She isn't smiling and seems perturbed, so I ask, "What's up?" Mariah replies, "The gypsy is asking something of you." "More money?" I ask as I lean back and start to reach into my pocket. "No, not that. Something else." She seems very serious and suspicious about the request. I lean in, saying, "What? Something else?" Mariah looks at the gypsy, and in a quiet voice, while nodding her head, the gypsy says to Mariah what sounds to me like words of encouragement. Mariah agrees, "Oui," then turns to me, explaining, "The gypsy would like you to kiss her." "The gypsy wants me to..." "What?" "To kiss her." Mariah gestures toward the gypsy. "On the other side of the table. To go to the other side of the table and kiss her." "Kiss the gypsy?" I ask incredulously. Mariah just nods her head, still seeming displeased about the situation. Hesitantly, I stand up, walk around the far side of the table, and lean over to give the gypsy the kind of kiss on her cheek that I would have given my grandmother had my grandmother asked me for a kiss. As I lean over, the gypsy grabs me by the hair on the back of my head and pulls me down to her, pressing my lips against hers in a surprising open-mouth kiss. French, I think they call it. From across the table, I hear Mariah draw a deep breath of surprise. I nearly react by pulling back and imagine it might be bad form to do so. After all, I suppose a gypsy can make trouble for me if she wants to. The kiss lasts only a few seconds before she lets me go. I stand up, avoid wiping the back of my hand against my mouth as I feel inclined to do, and look at Mariah to gauge her reaction. She smiles and shrugs her shoulders, not knowing what to say, but communicating a message of, "What can you do? C'est le jeu." As I return to my seat, the gypsy says something to Mariah. I wait for the translation, and Mariah explains. "She has given you some of her good fortune. She says you will lead a life filled with romance and adventure, and she wants $1 for all that good luck." I stand back up, pull out a $1 bill from my stash, and slide it across the table to her. She picks it up, saying, "Merci beaucoup." I nod, accepting the thanks and hoping some of what she predicted for me comes true, especially the adventure part of it, but definitely not the death will come for you 7 times part. Mariah bows her head toward the gypsy, saying, "Merci, bonne nuit." Mariah takes my hand, and we walk back outside the tent, returning to the lights and sounds of the carnival once again. We take a few steps and stop between tents in the semi-darkness. Mariah turns to me, grabs me by the collar, and gives me the second, but much more delightful, French kiss of my night. This kiss is longer, more passionate, more gratefully received, and reciprocated. When she lets go, without breaking eye contact, I reach to take her hand, brush a kiss across her fingers, and gently ask, "What was that all about?" She tosses her hair before responding. "I want some of the good luck, the good fortune the gypsy gave you, ma chérie." I look into her deep and beautiful eyes, and as lovingly as I can, recite Minata from memory. "Kiss me tonight without saying anything. Kiss me until the blood sprouts. Kiss me with rage. It is my farewell. Tomorrow I emigrate without knowing where." Before I can finish, Mariah puts her index finger gently on my lips and continues, "Kiss me until the dawn arrives. Kiss me with limitless passion. Kiss me, just kiss me, without saying anything." We laugh together and she says, "Du bénisse nos frères Christians." I don't know how to say that. It's God bless the Christian brothers in French.
Yes. God bless the Christian brothers.
Oh, I'm not very good at French.
I thought you did pretty good, except for the ville.
For the what?
Oh, you went a little bit of German on
Russian
me there.
Or something. Yeah. I'm not very good at French. I'll just admit that right up front, in case you didn't know. So that was A Gypsy's Kiss. That was the whole event that caused you to call everything in your life A Gypsy's Kiss from going forward from that.
Well, everything. Everything in the sense that I started naming boats that.
Boats and blogs. It
was the kind of thing. Whenever I wrote a blog, I call it, since it was about the boats, I called it A Gypsy's Kiss. But you're right. It was a memorable event in my life. And aside from the fact, it was like the pinnacle of the memorable first adventure. And I didn't put a lot of stock or weight into it until later in life. And I kept trying to keep the promise of what the gypsy had said, which is, you're going to lead a life full of romance and adventure. And when you're told that, you don't think of it as like, "Oh, well, okay, that's good. I hope it happens." You work to make it happen. And so it was always an excuse. That Gypsy's Kiss was always an excuse to make your life one of romance and adventure. And, you know, I don't claim that my life was romantic and adventurous in an Indiana Jones kind of way. It was just for the life that I expected to lead, which to me would have been kind of an average life. I didn't expect anything out of it. Things just kind of occurred that created the romance and adventure. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I get a little annoyed with Indiana Jones anyway. It's a little too formulaic. He works really, really hard to get whatever object he's after. And as soon as he gets it, somebody
takes it,
comes
away
along
from
him. And takes away from him. It's like, and it's every single time. It's like, come on. It gets a little old after a while.
I did like the female character in this most recent one. There is a tendency in the past to have made the female characters very, I don't want to say submissive, but very feminine, even though they're kind of adventurous. And this one went back to the first one, you know, Marion. This one is a little, you know, rougher around the edges and a little bit more raw and interesting, you know. Kind of a con artist, things like that. So I thought it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. So some of the themes and emotions that we've discussed here are adventure and destiny, obviously. He's reading is about adventure and encounters with death and destiny. And he's like, bring it on. Crossing boundaries and cultures. The water taxi ride and the encounter with the gypsy fortune teller highlights the crossing of the physical and cultural boundaries. I thought that was a good, you know, visual representation of that crossing over from childhood to manhood, you know, that crossing over from, you know, being Toby Michael to Miguel, the adventurer, you know, just that symbolic crossing over the river, you know, taking that last step in the journey. You're there, you made it to Mardi Gras, but now let's go a step further.
Well, the crossing over the river. So up until this point, the young man from Santa Fe, New Mexico, who had lived a life of relative ease in a Hispanic culture, right, was meeting motorcycle club riders, sheriffs, you know, people, I want to call them Kate and the McGees, you know, the John Boltons. The Boltons. To me, they're always in my head, McGees. And now a completely different culture. And it's a closed culture like Santa Fe is. Santa Fe, to me, was very Hispanic. You know, it wasn't until later in life that I realized we actually have three very distinct cultures in Santa Fe. The white, the Native American, and the Hispanic. And they do really well together, you know. But this was the after the visit to the gypsy. So you're right, the crossing the river was the crossing of the river into a completely new destiny. Because I think it's important for people to wake up every morning, well, maybe not necessarily every morning, but regularly sit back in some place they're comfortable. You know, a hammock under a tree and on a warm day where the breeze is actually rocking you, and asking yourself, what is my destiny? And I don't think you should ever stop asking yourself that question. I think you should treat yourself every once in a while to thinking about, what is my destiny? Why am I here? And where am I going? Because I think it gives you the opportunity to consider the possibilities. Nobody stops. I spent a lot of time this weekend telling everybody, and I'm not actually, I'm close to it, but I kept saying, I'm 75.
That's true.
I'm 75. I'm 70. Look at me. I'm 75. And as a result, on the flight back, as I closed my eyes, I didn't actually go to sleep as I usually do. Airplanes put me to sleep. Zonk, I get on the plane. It starts on the taxiway. I go to sleep. And I didn't actually sleep, but I had a lot of time to think about, well, here I am, 75. I just finished 2 days, 4 days total, but 4 days of effort in helping a good friend collect all the content necessary to make a credible documentary. And so I started thinking about that and how good I felt about what we had accomplished. Shelley, of course, was part of that. And I started thinking to myself, well, then what is my destiny? Where am I going from here at 75? And that's the thing that I want to express. Even at age 75, I feel like I have a destiny. And I think everyone should feel like they have destinies. And fate will help you get there. But it's not going to help you if you don't envision your destiny, where you're going, and what you're going to accomplish with the remainder of your life, and who you're going to need to help you, because we all need help to achieve our destiny. But it was a reminder, and that's why I thought you finding that adventure and destiny in it, because crossing the river was an indication of a new destiny. I hadn't even thought about it, and I didn't think about it much until, well, I don't want to tell anything about, I don't want to say something about any of the future chapters, but the river comes into play again in the book. And that's coming out of the river and spending the night with Mariah was kind of that. So what is my destiny? What's going to happen to me? What do I want to happen to me? What do I have to do to make sure that does happen to me? And so I think it's important for each one of us kind of once a month to ask ourselves, what is my destiny? Why am I here? And where am I going? And whose help do I need to get there? And who else can I help to achieve their destiny? So I think it's a good question to ask yourself regularly.
And then we have romance and relationships. Of course, we see the romance blossoming between Miguel and Mariah. And relationships, it kind of occurred to me, I was thinking about this as I was thinking about the book and the journey and how each time Miguel stops is not just about a place that he's stopping. It's about the people that he's meeting, and the people bring out the adventure and the relationship and the growth and what's happening. You know, there wouldn't be any excitement or adventure if there weren't people involved. Uh-huh. It would just be a trip. Uh-huh. It would be okay. You know, I drove here, I spent the night in the forest, and then I drove some more. Not very exciting. But the people that you meet and the interactions that you have with them, that makes all the difference, I think. You know, when we were gone to California over the weekend and we met people and the different people and the different personalities and the different events and, you know, what was going on with each of these people and their history and why they were there and what they brought to the documentary. You know, we had Brian, who came to talk about the birds, and he did provide a lot of information about the birds. But then later, when I was talking to him, I found that I had so much in common with him. Uh-huh. You know, just and that enhanced my whole trip, my uh-huh. whole experience, because I got to meet somebody who we had, you know, similarities in our past that we could talk about, and then you know, we met Walter, and he's a very different kind of person. And we could talk about, you know, how different he was and how he lived differently than anybody else. And, you know, just exploring those things, exploring relationships with each other. You know, it was our first time, the three of us going someplace together and staying in a house together like that. So that was a new experience. So the whole trip to California was this journey. But it became an adventure because of the people that we were with uh-huh. and the events that we attended with those people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it the excitement for me of traveling to go do the kind of work that I love doing the most was exciting. And I went with two of my best friends, you and Janet. You know, Janet and I have known each other at least as long as you and I have known each other. This will be the third documentary that we've worked on together. And we have the best origin story in that she wanted to do a documentary. So she started attending a class I was teaching. And the class was 10 weeks to your first documentary. It met, you know, once a week for 10 weeks. And I gave you all this information and additional materials to help you get there. And I guess about, I don't know, I always say it's week five just because I don't actually remember. She came up to me after class and she says, I want to do a documentary. And I've learned just by listening to you, I'll never know enough, right? Which was kind of bad news for my course because the idea was, and she asked me to work on the documentary. And of course, we went to California. We worked on Stories of the Spill. And after that, about 2 years later, we worked on another documentary called Heroes of the Coast. And this will be the third documentary that we've worked on together. And she trusts me that I will act in her best interest. She lets me do my stuff. If I tell her that the lights, we're going to use this camera, this set of lights, it's going to be set up this way, and I promise you it's going to look good, she trusts that. I don't have to promise it. She just literally trusts it. And I trust that what she's putting together, she has an idea as how the script is going to flow and the story that she wants to tell. And she basically says, here's what I need. She does a really good job of setting up the people who should be interviewed, including a couple of characters. One, Brian Foster, Dr. Brian Foster, who's a, I want to say molecular biologist, and Walter, who is the caretaker of the unofficial, unpaid caretaker of this of Ormond Beach Wetlands. And you couldn't find any more interesting a character. And when Janet said, we want to interview you, we were standing outside his RV, his trailer, which is where he lives. He's standing there. He's unshaven. He's dirty from having worked out in the wetlands all day. And he puts his hands in his pocket, and I put a microphone on him, and he talks for a half hour, if not longer, very informatively, and about, the wetlands and what his contribution to it and the people that he's chased away and the times that he's called the police for, people threatening him, things like that. I mean, it was just a really good story from a guy that you would never expect to. Honestly, your first reaction is he looks like a homeless person. He's not. He's the caretaker of the and has awards from people that were given to him for the work that he does. No, free of charge. Nobody pays him to do that, which, of course, surprised me. He deserves to be paid.
The thing that I thought was really cool was the whole time he's talking, little animals are coming by. First, you have the birds flying in, and then you have bunnies hopping by and squirrels coming by. And what did you see? You saw a ground squirrel?
I can't remember. It's another rodent member of the rodent family, but
several
I can never.
Little animals just coming on by to say
ducks,
hi.
All kinds of birds, ducks. They were all in the shot. Thankfully, it was the out of focus part, but you can see them in the background of the interview.
It was really cute.
So I did want to say one thing else. Oh, about the characters. That were in the book and the characters that you met. You've got to remember that Campbell, when he describes the hero's journey, has these several archetypes that help, that support the protagonist. There's an antagonist. There's other support members. It wouldn't be a hero's journey if it was all by the hero's self. I know that's probably a cumbersome way to put that. But if it was a hero having an adventure without anyone else supporting him, fighting him, helping him, arguing with him, giving him advice. It's not otherwise a hero's journey until you start getting all these other archetypes into it. And you can describe them. If you read Campbell's book, he does a really good job of breaking down each of the archetypes and what role they play in the hero's journey. And you got to remember, he wasn't writing a screenplay. He was writing a book about the consistency of the hero's journey throughout time and through the various cultures and the characteristics that they had and that were common to each of these stories. And each of them have a hero. Each of them have as the protagonist. Each of them have an antagonist, one or more. Each of them have consultants, advisors, older members of the tribe who give them consultation. They're all there. And so it's not much of a story without other people involved. And if you start watching one, if you start watching a movie where there's one character and then there's, I don't know, I guess you could turn nature into archetypes, but if it's just the character and he's rowing a boat across the ocean, it's not much of a story, you've got to have other characters in the story in order to give that character depth and the ability to learn from whatever the adventure is.
And of course, that's all based on humans, our stories, our real stories, and we all have those kinds of stories going on in our lives. You can look at your own. I've been looking at my own journey, thinking about, this has been a hard year. A lot of times I've said, I just want it to be over. I just want to move on. I just want the next thing to come. I want this thing to be over. And today I was on my walk listening to podcasts, thinking about it. And I was like, you know, I probably shouldn't do that. It kind of, there's learning and growth in every experience. I shouldn't wish for it to, you know, to be over so quickly and miss out on the opportunity to learn something or to grow from it, because I probably need that growth and that learning for the days ahead. So instead, I need to be looking at each thing that comes my way and saying, what can I learn from this? You know, how, where is this going to take me on my journey? So next.
What's your destiny?
What is my destiny? My destiny is to be of service. Not sure to who and to what yet exactly, but yeah, that's it in a nutshell. Mystery and the supernatural. So we discovered that Toby's mom, or Miguel's mother, told fortunes. This was the first time I'd heard about it. She read the tarot cards for her friends, and the gypsy got the tarot cards out and was just like, okay, well, this is going to be like what mom does. So that was kind of different and interesting to me, because I know your mom was religious, and it seems to be two different paths for most people, that if you're religious, then you're anti-tarot cards. So how did that come together?
So first of all, she was religious, but she was a Catholic. And I think for Catholics, it all fits in. There's santerias. There's all these other areas of religion that aren't necessarily by the book religion, and the Catholic Church seems to allow it. And that's because I think the Catholic Church has its own form of spirituality. I don't think other churches, for example, I don't remember you told me what religion you grew up as.
Nazarene.
Nazarene. Do they have saints?
No.
Yeah. See, we have saints. We have, we do have angels. We all have angels, but we have saints. We have the Virgin Mother, the Immaculate Conception. So there's all this other than spirituality, other spirituality that has nothing to do with a religion. And so there's, they form their own. We know all over the world, there's various forms of a Catholicism that involve candles and altars and prayers and cutting off of chickens' heads and et cetera, et cetera. It's all part of the religion. So tarot, if you look at tarot, it can be interpreted from a very religious perspective. I mean, you know, all the coins, swords, cups, and I forgot the other one. Coins, swords, cups. And the two arcana, you know, it can be viewed as spiritual. And it was always, when she presented it, it was always religious in the sense that she would say, oh, well, here's this card and it represents this. So you're going to have to pray to make sure that it doesn't get it. That, to me, growing up and watching it, it never struck me as exclusive of religion, of Catholicism. It always seemed to be tied into it somehow. And I don't think anybody else at the table, to them, it wasn't witchcraft, although they used to say, es un bruja, she's a witch. And you didn't want to get the ojo. What's the ojo? That's the evil eye. Like, you don't want her to give it. So, but they all saw it as part of the, you know, in the context of Catholicism, which is a bit of, has its own mysticism, you know, along with it, as opposed to, you know, and I'll tell you, I used to hear my mother and her friends say that other religions were boring in comparison to Catholicism, because we had all these extra things, rosaries and saints and hosts and you know, Good Fridays and no meat, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We had all these other things that other religions just go, no, we get together, you know, and this, I'm not saying, I've never experienced it, other religion, but it's like, no, we just get together and we sing on Sundays, you know, then we go home, have dinner, With Catholics, it's always something, man. It's always rosaries and kneeling. And did you ever kneel? Do other religions kneel?
Occasionally.
Do they?
Occasionally.
No, this was occasions. Kneeling, sitting, standing, kneeling.
I've done both, so I know. Okay. Just, I converted because, my husband was Catholic, so... Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's to me, it was always more interesting than the other religions I heard about, but I didn't practice any of them. Of course, eventually I didn't practice any of them, but there was always a lot of choirs and choir practice. And
so many feast days and stations cross, and my goodness, yeah.
September 29th, St. Michael's feast day. I used to celebrate it with all the other Michaels at St. Michael's High School.
All the other Michaels.
Seemed to be a ton of us.
And we have youthful innocence and experience. Miguel's expectations for a grandmotherly kiss versus the unexpected kiss from the gypsy reflect his youthful innocence. Mariah's willingness to share in the good fortune symbolizes the exuberance and curiosity of youth.
I think that's what it was. We're still talking about two youthful. She was far more experienced in the ways of her world than I was, but she was youthful nonetheless. You know, I always wondered what did she think about our adventure? What did she think about it? We never got to have the conversation afterwards. It would have been fun to meet, 20 years later at a high school reunion or something, and go like, "Well, what have you been doing? What are you up to? What's been as everyone will find later in the book, I only found out a little bit about her, and I never went back to New Orleans to look her up or find her. I never had a reason to. My destiny was different from that, as I discovered on the train ride back. But it was. There was a lot of... It's like two young people trying to be a little bit more adult than they're entitled to be because of their age. But it was working out. Like, a lot happened that night that most youthful people in that age group will never experience, hopefully.
Then we have humor and playfulness, empowerment and agency. I like the empowerment and agency. Mariah taking charge and negotiating the fortune telling on Miguel's behalf, as well as willingly embracing Miguel and initiating the kiss, demonstrate the themes of empowerment and agency. Mariah's actions showcase her strength and independence.
And she was. And you had to remember, I didn't know what her relationship with her parents was. She seemed to me to have a good relationship with her grandfather, but I never found out anything much about her family life. I remember one of the things that we did on our trip, as we were going to hide the treasure in Louisiana, we were going down this little barely two-lane road with no markings, and we passed this house, cabin really on the side of the road that had I not known better that it wasn't, struck me as, I want to take this picture because that's the kind of place that I would have imagined she lived in the bayou. Now we weren't in the bayou. It was just off the side of the road, but it looked like it'd be that kind of place. And it was funny because it wasn't a dump. It didn't have old refrigerators or pickup trucks out front. It looked very well cared for, but it looked like it was made in the 1930s, and it just hadn't gone beyond that. I would have loved to have seen it at night to see if there was actually oil lamps in the windows, that kind of thing. Yeah. But I imagine that's the kind of life she led, and that somewhere she had loving parents, and that this evil man that she'd somehow come in contact with was not good for her, and sooner or later she'd realize that. So,
it's giving me
a
connection to like Cassidy Hutchinson.
Yeah, I actually kind of
and I'm picturing her, as Mariah.
And she has kind of the same color tone. She looks like she's a much taller person. Mm. Mariah wasn't much taller, any taller than me, although the shoes she was wearing brought her up to my height. But she had that same color, the dark hair, dark eyes, and that same kind of Cassidy Hutchinson look of patience, like, I like the way that she waits until the question is completed before she answers it. And then she has very precise, very complete, very well-organized responses. I'm very impressed with her. I was sorry to hear. I'm interested. I got the Audible version of her book, and I'm very interested to see what the last line was, because Lawrence said he's not going to read it on camera because he's a crybaby and he might start crying. So I think she's been like a lot of women. The men in her life have done everything to hurt her and nothing to help her. And that makes me sad.
Yeah.
I don't think women deserve that.
Yeah. And so, and like Mariah, it's good to see them when they have agency and command of a situation.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of root for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Emotionally, the chapters evoke a range of feelings, including curiosity, excitement, surprise, amusement, tenderness, and joy. The unexpected events, the budding romance, and the humorous interactions contribute to an emotionally engaging reading experience. And I recommend that you guys check that out if you haven't yet read the book and you're interested in reading ahead. Make sure you check it out online. It's on Amazon if you'd like to get your own copy. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this chapter?
No. I thought, of course, my favorite chapter because of the story it tells and how it affected me. Literally, I can show you pictures of boats with the name A Gypsy's Kiss on the back of the boat.
And do you feel like you have encountered death seven times?
I was trying to go through it as you mentioned it. So I was counting the number of times that I came close.
Yeah.
Right. The first big one was when I had that motorcycle racing accident at Fort Sumner. Then there were the three events in Vietnam. And then there was the lightning strike.
That's five.
And then, so there was that event in Serbo-Croatia during the war. But I don't feel like that was a near-death experience. That, you know, I just felt like, oh, well, it's a sticky wicket here. What do I do now? You know? So I'd say five of the seven. Or six. What did you say? Which one? Which one?
A heart attack?
Oh, good. Yeah. Isn't that funny? I'm going to make that. No, that's
right.
Forgot
about that.
Heart attack on an airplane, crossing the Atlantic from London back to Washington, D.C. I had given a presentation in London and had it.
And that's at least six, maybe seven.
So I have one more?
Maybe. Mm.
How could I forget the heart attack?
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you have.
So that was 1998. So that was 25 years ago. I used to have a doctor, Dr. Summers, and when I was, she was my doctor after the heart attack. I had a stent put. They put a stent in my heart to correct whatever damage I had done. And well, there's a bunch of funny stories associated with this. I say funny. Could have been tragedy, but time equals comedy. I was sitting next to my wife, and we were on one of the first Boeing 777 flights. And the company that had paid me to make the speech had paid for first class seats. So we're sitting right next to each other. We had TVs. This was when they put TVs in the seat in front of you. And she was watching something different from me. And I knew there was something going wrong. I could feel it. And she was having her dinner. We were having dinner, right? And I looked at her and I said, there's something wrong. And she took her headset off. And she said, what? I said, there's something wrong. I feel like there's something wrong. And she said, well, go in the back, see if they can help you. Like, I didn't know to express like how bad it was, because she was going to watch this movie and have her dinner. So she was actually sitting in the aisle. So I went to the back and there were a couple of flight attendants back there. And I started to say something. And one of the flight attendants said, oh, my God, sit down. And I guess my skin had turned ashen, as they call it, really. I looked terrible. And she said, are you feeling all right? And I said, there's something going on. I feel like, and I kept rubbing my chest, of course. And they said, is there anyone on board? Are there any doctors on board? And like six men and women of various nationalities came back, and because there had been they had been attending a conference that had to do with heart specialists. So it was, I was on the right flight. The funny part is none of them had any medication that could do any good. They give you
nitroglycerin.
You'd think they'd have some, and I didn't carry it because
it was the first time
you
needed it.
And but they all had aspirin, so that helped. And then they kept me on oxygen. They brought me back. So by this time, the pilot had come back, and they're trying to decide what do we do now, because they were taking the route, the polar route, and it would have brought us through Newfoundland and then back down the coast, right? And they were going to literally land at Goose Bay, which was an American Air Force base in Newfoundland, right at the tip of Newfoundland, and drop me off there. Like, we'll drop him off and then we'll continue our flight. We're like, what? Like, I don't want to be in Goose Bay, Newfoundland, or something like that. So I don't feel like I convinced them. They just talked about it and they said, okay, well, let's change the flight. We're going to fly directly to Washington, D.C. And what made it even funnier is, as this was going on, eventually the pilot went forward and he said, good news, ladies and gentlemen, we've been rerouted directly to Washington. So we're going to take about an hour and a half out of our flight time. And he made it sound, he didn't say why. They brought me back to my seat, kind of put me in blankets, gave me an oxygen bottle. So I kept breathing the oxygen. And then they told everybody what was going on as we landed at Dulles. And by that time, they had contacted the Reston Medical Center and their EMTs. And so instead of going straight to the jetway, they went over to one side on the taxiway and they lowered the stairs, and they brought some EMTs on board. And they wheeled me out and down into the ambulance. We rode to the hospital, and then they realized that they didn't have the facilities there. So here was the best part of the whole thing. They gave me a bunch of stuff that basically allows your blood to flow better. It thins your blood. But by that time, I'm bleeding from my eyes, my ears, everywhere. And they had me in an emergency room solo, but they didn't have any heart specialists at the time. They just had an emergency room. And I heard the doctor, they closed the thing, and the doctor told my wife, said to my wife, do you have any children? And she said, yeah, we do. And he says, you should probably get them over here. He's probably not going to make it through the night. And I heard that. I'm like, what? I am not ready to go. I didn't feel like I was ready to go on the airplane or anything like that. And so about 2 hours later, they decided that they were going to take me from Reston to Fairfax Inova, which was the biggest hospital in the area, and they can do anything. And they're good. I mean, they were really great. And the way they decided to do it to get me there faster was they put me on a helicopter. Well, I thought, okay, helicopter, they're going to put me in the back, and it's going to be four seats. We're going to type, we got the headset on. No, it was one of those old-style helicopters where they had the basket, you know, the metal basket on the outside of the helicopter. They put me in the basket, buckled me in. I'm flying, looking at the rotor overhead. Now, don't get me wrong, I flew helicopters the whole time I was in the military, but I had never been looking up at the rotor, knowing that there was, you know, 1,500 feet below me. And I just thought, I had a heart attack. Why would you want to scare the crap out of me any more than?
And this is a guy who almost died in a helicopter crash in Vietnam. So, yeah.
Anyway, I probably went on, but you got to look at it. You know, I learned this from Shelley. Tragedy plus time equals comedy. It was a big comedy thing. Got to the hospital. The doctor came in. This doctor was so young that she could have been my daughter. I swear. I couldn't see, like, what are we going to do? And she said, what we're going to do is stent. And she described it. They cut open your leg. They take the stent. They put it up your veins until it gets to your heart. Leave it there and boom, you're done.
Boom, you know? You're done.
So, anyway.
So that was fun.
All right. So that was number six.
Yeah. Unless it was number seven.
No, I think I got the others. One, two, three, four.
You said the thing in Bosnia, was it? Sarajevo? Where was
it? That was in Serbo-Croatia. Well, it became Bosnia afterwards, but it was during the Serbo-Croatian War.
That was you're not sure because you weren't actually injured or anything.
No,
you just threatened.
Yeah. I was just threatened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're not sure if that
I don't feel like that was number seven. I think I still have maybe seven and one more to go before.
We're going to go with that. We'll go with that.
Well, I don't necessarily want to go through a near death experience. Criminy sake.
Another one.
Yeah.
You've had enough of those for a while. Yeah. Well, you, okay. It's been 25 years, so
maybe it's not going to
get a little rest. Yeah. All right. Well, we hope that you enjoyed this episode, and you will share it with your family and friends and tell them to check out our story, your story, and join us again next week as Miguel and Mariah make their way to Algiers for some more adventures.
Some more adventure, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for watching.
Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story because your story matters.